Happy Thursday, everybody. Welcome in to ESPN 102.5 The Game. We're streaming all around the world on the Game Nashville app. What's up? Darren, Donick, and Chase. Chase McCabe, Willie Donick here with you today. I'm out in Bellevue. He's on the east side. Elijah Campbell back at the Wholesale Link Studios powered by RumbleOn.com. DMAC on vacation. Much deserved for the next couple of days. Willie, what's up?
Hello, Chase. Good to talk to you.
Yeah. I know yesterday we talked about the draft, the NBA draft that was held last night at ESPN in Bristol, Connecticut. And I said, yeah, I usually don't really watch drafts. I don't know if I'll check it out. I lied. I did. I actually watched like the first five picks, some of the pre-draft show. I thought some of the features they did on the players was pretty cool, pretty telling, and learned a little more about these guys.
Yeah, I watched it all the way through when Aaron Nesmith got picked, and then I probably had it on, was walking around not paying as much attention after that. But the story of the draft, of course, is really exciting night for Vanderbilt, who, you know, trying to build back through Jerry Stackhouse. As we know, John Calipari has certainly proven this, that, you know, you can get some good momentum recruiting-wise when you can showcase your players and show that you have players that can move on and get drafted to the NBA. They've got a long way to go, as we know. But that was a great night. And also, I thought it was pretty cool. James Wiseman was in Nashville when he was picked. There was some great family shots, and that was something that I know jumped out at you, kind of like the NFL draft. They had sort of the same format, but just the overwhelming emotions that you saw from the families and the players, some of which couldn't even conduct the interview, right? They were so overwhelmed, they just literally could not get words out to answer the basic questions. It was really heartfelt. So I actually enjoyed it up through pick number 14. And then my son texted me right away when Saban Lee got picked, I think even earlier than some people thought. I think his pick, and as we had every year, you got picks jumping around, being promised and in future trades to other teams. I think he's going to end up with Detroit. But, you know, that was cool stuff, good stuff.
Yeah, I thought the piece on Anthony Edwards and his mom and his grandma, he lost them when he was about 14, both to cancer, and had the paintings behind him. So they were, you know, they were there in spirit as he got drafted number one overall. And that was the conversation we had yesterday of, okay, is he going to be – the number one overall pick, and I thought the analysis by Jay Williams and Jay Billis was pretty spot on. Jay Billis was saying, you know, I think he's got every piece you would want in a player, but does he love the game? How much does he love the game? What is he willing to put work-wise in to be able to live up to that number one pick? Well, now he has to do it. And the Timberwolves, I know they shopped it around, but they took a chance on him and drafted him number one overall, and then, as you mentioned, James Wiseman goes second overall to the Golden State Warriors, played, three games for Memphis, and now he's the second overall pick in the NBA. And LaMelo Ball had the Ball family. They were all there. Had LeVar with his I told you so hat on and his headphones. And but he goes, he's going to play for MJ in Charlotte. So pretty interesting night overall. Elijah, what kind of stood out to you?
There was some surprises. I think Patrick Williams going four to Chicago was a real stunner for me. I kind of pinned him as a late lottery pick, as another guy who didn't crack the starting lineup at Florida State, and I didn't think he was the best player on his own college team. I think Devin Vassell was the better prospect of the two, and the Spurs got him at a steal at 11. But the first three kind of went as expected. However, of every NBA draft I think I've ever watched, I think this one has the most uncertainty with the guys at the top three, considering, like you said, Wiseman played three games, LaMelo Ball played in Australia and only played about 10 games in Australia before he shut it down early, and then Anthony Edwards played a lot of meaningless basketball early on. You make a good point about Anthony Edwards, too, is that he does have all the physical traits needed to be even an all-star in the NBA, but a lot of the stuff that's wrong with him, in my opinion, is things that can be coached, but he's got bad shot selection. Sometimes he takes himself out of the game when the shots aren't falling. One example at least was when they played Kentucky at Georgia. Georgia had a decent sized lead at halftime, and Anthony Edwards was hitting everything he shot up. And the second half, I mean, of course, they showed a little clip of him, you know, talking some junk to the Kentucky bench or whatever. And Kentucky makes a run in the second half, and it just falls apart. He was taking some bad shots, a lot of really, I guess, immature things that like a college freshman would do. And there's a lot of that stuff that Minnesota is going to have to work out of him. And my only concern with him is Minnesota is not really known for working that out of guys, as we saw with Andrew Wiggins, as he was, you know, has every physical gift in the book to be a great basketball player and just never got better from the time he got in the NBA. So it's going to take some coaching, and he could be something down the road, and he could even be a little bit of a project. But that was the fun part about last night is too, is that the value was later in the draft. I think Aaron Nesmith at 14 for Boston is a steal. And I think guys like Devin Vassell for the Spurs and Tyrese Haliburton at 12 for Sacramento is an absolute steal. Cause Haliburton, I think, is every bit as good as LaMelo Ball, and they got him late in the lottery. So there were a lot of stories like that. And Saben Lee getting picked was a little bit of a surprise for me. I didn't expect him to get picked at all.
I was hopeful, but I was not sure, and definitely not as early as he did. That was fairly early in the second round.
Mm-hmm. And that's an analytics pick too. I mean, a lot of when you look at basketball and like the analytics movement there, it's obviously three pointers get all the love because that has been the most dramatic change in the game. But an emphasis on being able to get to the line is almost the basketball equivalent of on-base percentage and using that to make personnel decisions. And Saben Lee has one of the highest free throw rates of any NBA prospect the last couple of years. He almost got his free throw rate was about 49.8. So for every two shots he's taking, he's going to the line at least once. So, and that's a really valuable trait that a lot of NBA teams look at when trying to get free agents or trading for certain players, and now you're seeing them do that for college prospects too, and Saben Lee's a little bit of a byproduct of that. So he kind of does play a little bit like Derrick Rose does now. So I thought that was a really interesting pairing, him and Detroit, but that's awesome. He got picked a lot earlier than I would have expected.
What do we think about – I've been watching all the national shows this morning, and they're talking about Obi Toppin going to the New York Knicks. And did the Knicks get it right? What do we think about that pick? What do you guys think? Willie, what do you think?
Well, I'm gonna defer again to Elijah because he was the one last year during the college basketball season that was pointing out all the amazing things that Obi Toppin was doing. And when I was putting together my list for the John Wooden Award, which I voted for on now for, I think, over 10 years, don't know exactly when I started, but Elijah helped me put together, based on some analytics, just how good he is. He's from New York. You know, it's hard to trust the Knicks. We know that, how often they get it wrong. But you mentioned the analytics angle to Toppin, Elijah. I think that was probably a big one in this pick, too.
Oh, for sure. And, of course, the knock on him coming in, too, was that he doesn't have a lot of lateral quickness. So guarding some NBA, guards is going to be really tough for him. But offensively, I mean, the guy doesn't miss around the rim at all. This last year, Dayton had one of the best two-point shooting teams. They shot almost 70% as a team from two this past year, and that's why they were so good. And a lot of that was Obi Toppin shooting almost 70% from the field. I mean, he was one of four players, I guess, to win Player of the Year and shoot at least 65% from the field, the other three being Zion Williamson, Bill Walton, and Lou Alcindor. That's pretty good company.
That's pretty good. Those are good names.
In. He just doesn't miss around the rim, and he's elite in transition. I like the fit in New York personnel-wise because if they want to play fast, he's your guy. He's fabulous in transition, and that's really the strength of his game. My only concern is him playing with Tom Thibodeau, who isn't known for offensive coaching. His style of play is more slow it down, grind it out defensive ball like you saw with the Bulls in the early 2010s, back when they were competing with the Miami Heat's Big Three. They were not very good offensive team, and they would just slow it down. They minimize possessions. I don't know if that fits Obi Toppin's strengths, but if they want to push the pace and up the tempo a little bit, Obi Toppin's going to be just fine, just because offensively, he can score at three different levels, and he can get to the rim really whenever he wants. And he's a little bit of a late bloomer, too. That's another knock. He's about 22 years old and was only
a sophomore.
But he
was, 6'2"? In high school? Yeah. And then has grown like a weed since then.
Yeah.
A little bit like Luke Kornet.
Exactly.
Or Scottie Pippen.
And of course, he's got good genes, too. His dad was on the And One mixtape tour, for anyone who remembers that. So he was a streetball legend in New York, and that's kind of where he gets the hops, because he is an incredible leaper.
And he led the nation in dunks, I think.
By a mile. Yeah.
So that's
And that's
107 dunks.
That's a ton.
That's amazing.
And of course, it's another part of the analytics movement too. I guess you can talk about, like, in the NBA, it's getting good open threes and then getting easy shots. And there's not much of an easier shot than a slam dunk. And Obi Toppin gets to the rim and dunks it a lot. So I love it for the Knicks. I just don't love the coach-player pairing.
Right. Well, we'll see if Tom Thibodeau can adjust and realize, okay, I got the player. I just need to make it work for him. So time will tell. We'll talk to Vanderbilt basketball coach Jerry Stackhouse coming up today at 1 about a couple of his players getting drafted and get his thoughts on the draft overall, plus silly underdog picks coming up at noon, Floyd Reese, the GM, at 11, and then in just a few minutes we'll talk to Paul Feinbaum, our weekly with him from ESPN and the SEC Network. We got a lot coming on a Thursday, Willie. And so we'll step aside, come back with Paul Feinbaum of the SEC Network. That's next. Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game.
All them dogs are counting down, about to put the anchor down. Hotty toddy, who's
back here, Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Chase McCabe, Willie Donick here with you on a Thursday. Darren McFarlane on vacation. And as we do every Thursday at this time, we say hello to Paul Feinbaum of the SEC Network and ESPN, and he's brought to you by Gary Force Acura and MTGRT.com, your live and local mortgage expert. Paul, how are you?
I'm doing great, guys. What's going on?
Not too much. I mean, so far, not as many cancellations as we saw last week or postponements. We know Ole Miss and Texas A&M is one in the SEC, but it seems like we got a pretty full schedule this weekend, and that's going to be nice.
Yeah, it's pretty much, it's hitting everyone else this week. The only game I think that is in serious jeopardy is Missouri, South Carolina, but I'm not sure if that game was postponed, anyone would notice.
Yeah, well, the only thing that I guess newsworthy with that is, and I'll start with that, South Carolina making the change after they lost to Ole Miss. Will Muschamp is out as the head coach. I know we've discussed with you in the past of, do coaches get a COVID pass? Are they going to be able to survive? Well, South Carolina didn't think so, and they ultimately made the change. Were you surprised?
Yes, on one level because of what we all said, but I will add that as the situation became worse, it almost seemed more palatable to fire him than to say, you know what, we don't really care about winning. We're going to let him stick around because we don't want to pay the buyout. Sometimes those can be more expensive in the long run. And to South Carolina's credit, they made the right decision here. You know, 13 to 16 million. I've heard all different variations on the buyout. It doesn't really matter. It's a lot of money. And Will Muschamp is a terrible coach in terms of being a head SEC coach, but he is a brilliant businessman because he picks up about 14 here. He made seven from getting fired from Florida. So anyone that can make $21 million net for being mediocre is my kind of guy.
You watch and you see the decisions that he's made, whether it was at Florida, South Carolina, the record speaks for itself. And so that tells you, okay, he's a good coordinator, just not a good head coach. But I always wonder, you know, deeper than that of why. Why just hasn't it worked for him as a head coach because of all the others that he's been around and he's learned from? What were some of the things that stood out to you that made you think, it was never going to click?
I think the things that make him a great coordinator, he's volatile, he's emotional, hurt him as a head coach. I think he made poor decisions. I think he was too stubborn at times. And you know, he relied on certain skill sets that he has as a defensive coach, and when those failed him, it really caught up. And yeah, at Florida, he never could make a good call on the offensive coordinator. He struggled at South Carolina as well. And you know, sometimes you're just not very good at being a head coach, and I think that's the case with him because there may have just been too much on the plate. Now, for those who don't know, and I would think most do, I mean, he's a Nick Saban protege. He was at LSU with Saban. He even went to the Dolphins with Saban. And, you know, I thought Florida was – he was in over his head there because of the stature of the school. South Carolina seemed about right, but it's also worth remembering he got the job only because Kirby Smart originally accepted it, and then when Georgia found out, they fired Mark Richt. So it was never a great circumstance. He had one good year, pretty much like he did at Florida. But, you know, some people are just not consistently good, and he is one of them.
Hugh Freeze is going to be the hot name connected to any job opening this year because of the success that he's had at Liberty. We all know the baggage that comes with him. And so some people that we've talked to have kind of said, I don't know if they go that direction. Billy Napier's name has been thrown out there quite a bit from Louisiana. What are some names that you're hearing?
I think it seems like Billy Napier is the hot name. Word is he turned down Mississippi State last year with South Carolina in mind. He's from the area. He's got ties. He was at Clemson before Clemson became Clemson. And, Shane Beamer's a name I hear a lot about. He was there under Spurrier. He was responsible for some of the big recruits that they had during Spurrier's pretty impressive run. I think Hugh Freeze has a double-edged problem. I think the personal conduct issues don't mesh well, nor do the NCAA baggage. And it's worth remembering that while Ray Tanner is the person out front, the former baseball coach turned athletic director, I think ultimately the decision will be made by the fairly new president. His name is Bob Caslam, and he comes from West Point, where he was a three-star general. He was the commandant there. He just wrote a book on character, and somehow I don't see him introducing Hugh Freeze at the opening press conference and saying, "Here's a copy of my book on character. Read it."
Paul Feinbaum.
Doesn't quite fit.
Not quite. Paul Feinbaum, the SEC Network and ESPN, here with us. Now shifting gears, Tennessee had the week off because of a postponement. Now they will take on Auburn. These are two programs that always seem to have some question marks surrounding them, at least the last couple of years. Now, Auburn has maybe turned some things around. Tennessee, Jeremy Pruitt, noncommittal on his starting quarterback. Is it going to be Garantano? Is it going to be Harrison Bailey? Is it going to be somebody else? What do you make about this matchup this week?
I think I've used this phrase before, but he better win. And I say that because Auburn is not a great team. They've had some COVID issues because their game was scrubbed last week. They did lose to South Carolina. They've had some impressive wins. I mean, they're very inconsistent. They probably should have lost Ole Miss, probably should have lost Arkansas. I mean, they're beatable. And I say you better win because you have a four-game losing streak, and the Texas A&M game, I presume, will be played at some point. He's also got Florida. Those are not winnable games. So I think of the important remaining games, this is probably the most winnable. And I don't think Jeremy Pruitt is in any danger, obviously. We know about the extension, and Philip Fulmer gets one. But he's fighting a credibility issue right now. And the one thing he doesn't need is to lose this game, which will be five losses. Probably lose Florida and Texas A&M, which would be seven losses, and then have to go into next year clearly on the hot seat. That's not where you want to be, and you juxtapose that to how he entered this season, and it's the most dramatic turnaround in the SEC from a guy who seemed like he was headed toward a good career to someone who may be heading toward the end.
Well, what does it say to you when the paper in Knoxville puts an article out today, what it would cost to buy out Jeremy Pruitt and his staff, and the numbers they have, $12.88 million for Jeremy Pruitt if they fire the entire staff, $19.2 million. I mean, you know that conversation is being had in different circles in Knoxville, but as you said, it's going to be tough to make that move right now in a pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, think about 3 years ago at this moment, we were having the exact same conversation. That is the most frustrating part, and if you're a Tennessee fan out there, you're going, how did this happen? And listen, this one's on Philip Fulmer. You can't blame this one on some other athletic director, John Kerr, or go back 10 years to Mike Hamilton, as someone did the other day on our show. This is Philip Fulmer's decision. He made it. It's his. The extension now looks completely idiotic. And this is a problem, because once you get that into the air, and you really can't undo it without winning. And Jeremy Pruitt is not a savvy guy. I mean, Muschamp, for all of his faults, was a personable guy. I mean, I don't know anyone in the media who didn't like him. Kind of guy you wanted to have a beer with on the beach in the summertime. That's not Jeremy Pruitt, and I don't know what Jeremy Pruitt's going to say if this season goes to a 3-7 record, and he's going to talk about in the offseason how much better Tennessee is going to be next year. It's not going to be viable or believable.
Paul Finebaum is with us from ESPN and the SEC Network. You can hear his show this afternoon on 94.9 Game 2. He is presented by MTGRT.com and Gary Force Acura. Paul, another element from the reporting from the Knoxville News Sentinel was eight assistant coaches for Tennessee turned down the chance to take a pay cut voluntarily to help out with the financial issues that everybody's having right now. T. Martin and Jay Graham did. It doesn't seem like that's a very good look, especially in light of everything going on.
It's a terrible look, and I would say most people in almost every major industry, you've had to face that. We did it in my position, in my job. They came to us, and you do it because, you know, whether you want to or not, it's the right thing. You think maybe by doing it, you're helping someone else at another level, and this is a very bad look for this staff, who's not overly impressive anyway. And you lose goodwill in the community. I mean, you have Tennessee fans in Nashville, Knoxville, Memphis, who are out of work, who are struggling to make ends meet. And they look at these coaches making $1 million a year, $1.5 million a year. And they refuse to take a pay cut, to try to help other people within their department. And that's what we're talking about. You're not saving mankind by taking a 10%. You're helping people who make less money that help support what you do, and that's where they're in trouble. And you know, I don't know if anybody has talked. I haven't. You know, I didn't see that. I mean, I heard about the article, but I'd like to hear somebody explain it because these are highly paid people. And I'm not saying they have easy jobs, but you go into coaching, you know what you're getting into.
Speaking of coaches that have been through the ringer, for sure, we know that Nick Saban has done a really good job with a lot of coaching reclamation projects. I'm curious your thoughts. Do you think this is the year that Steve Sarkisian will get an opportunity somewhere that he likes to be a head coach again?
Yeah, I mean, his name has also been mentioned on the outside at South Carolina. I think he'll get some. It depends on how many opportunities come open. He could have gone to Colorado last year, and yeah, that was a strategic decision not to go there. It looked like a bad job, and it is a bad job because Mel Tucker blew out of there as fast as he could. So ultimately, he has redeemed himself. He was the head coach at Washington and USC. He was fired for public drunkenness, and it seems like he has gotten his life back together again, and most important, his coaching career.
Paul, the Florida comes through Nashville this weekend. They should be able to name how many points they want against Vanderbilt's defense. And so it's probably going to be another huge statistical day for Kyle Trask. And I saw some odds makers make him the favorite to win the Heisman right now. Of course, it helps that Lawrence hasn't played in a couple of weeks. Fields didn't play last week. But do you think he has a realistic shot here?
I think his only shot is an upset over Alabama on the last day that really matters. So he's well positioned, but you're right about Trevor Lawrence. Once he comes back, once we see Justin Fields again, neither played last week, I think it will be difficult. So, I mean, I think what you're going to get from a regional standpoint, Mac Jones and Kyle Trask, I think, are going to divvy up the votes in the SEC. And, you know, maybe the winner of the SEC championship game, depending on who it is, you know, the quarterback looks the best. But I don't give him – I would not make him the favorite because I just don't think he can stay. I mean, his numbers stand up, but I don't think the rest of it is going to comfort him. And by the way, I mean, I talked to Dan Mullen yesterday on our program. And I mean, Dan's had Alex Smith and Dak Prescott and obviously Tebow. And I mean, he even sounded surprised how well Kyle Trask is playing.
Last thing for you, Paul. I know how much you're in touch with a lot of the basketball coaches and basketball scene in the SEC. It was a great night last night. It was interesting to see a lot of first-round picks come from the league, and they weren't all Kentucky, right? So it shows you that there is some growth, and the league is getting deeper and stronger. But what are coaches telling you in terms of the serious challenges of getting through the season right now? I know the radar is really not on basketball yet for a huge portion of SEC fans, but The game being played inside, all of that stuff, it's going to be tough just like everything else.
It's going to be very challenging because, you know, when you do contact tracing in football, you may knock out, a number of players, but you could still perhaps get a game in. In basketball, I don't know how you're going to be able to do that. And I have talked to a lot of coaches. In fact, we have Calipari on today. I won't mention the draft last night. And I think you're going to see a lot of games canceled, but ultimately the basketball season is about one thing. It's about the NCAA tournament. And where you hear Greg Sankey talk about the SEC championship being the finish line, that's what it's all about. They have already figured out a way to make it easier with the so-called bubble in Indy. But, you will see multiple games canceled. I think that's what coaches are indicating. And it is going to be a jigsaw puzzle to get to the finish line.
Paul, we'll see if we can get through it. Thank you very much for your insight. As always, we will talk to you again next week.
It's a pleasure, guys. See you then.
All right, great stuff. Paul Feinbaum, SEC Network. Of course, the Feinbaum Show, you can hear it every day on ESPN 94.9 Game 2. He is brought to you by MTGRT.com and Gary Force Acura. Chase, take it away.
Yes, I have been telling you about BetMGM Sports for weeks now. I've had a lot of success on it. I know others that have had success on it. They've been able to get their winnings, cash out. It's very easy. You do it through the app. It connects to your bank account. Within a few days, you have your money lickety-split. It is that simple. So if you haven't taken the plunge yet, listen up because they have an offer for you. And they can tell you why they are the king of sportsbooks. Right now, new customers have a chance to win $100 in free bets when they place a $1 money line wager on the Cardinals or the Seahawks tonight. And if either team scores a touchdown, you win. All you have to do is use the bonus code 1025GAME100, 1025GAME100 when you make your first bet, and that's how you take advantage of that offer. It is easy. If you're ready to start turning... if you're ready to start betting with confidence and turning big plays into paydays like I have been able to do, and you've heard me talk about it, then all you got to do is sign up. Do it. Sign up today. Discover BetMGM's innovative parlay selection tools, boosted odds specials, daily promotions, and much more. Download the app or go to BetMGM.com. Use that bonus code 1025GAME100 to win $100 in free bets when you wager $1 on the Cardinals or the Seahawks to score a touchdown. It's always showtime at BetMGM Sports. Visit BetMGM.com for terms and conditions. You must be 21 years or older. You must be present in Tennessee. For gambling problem support, call the Tennessee Red Line at 800-889-9789.
Yeah, I mean, think about 3 years ago at this moment, we were having the exact same conversation. That is the most frustrating part. And if you're a Tennessee fan out there, you're going, how did this happen? And listen, this one's on Philip Fulmer. You can't blame this one on some other athletic director, John Kerr, or, go back 10 years to Mike Hamilton, as someone did the other day on our show. This is Philip Fulmer's decision. He made it. It's his. The extension now looks completely idiotic. And this is a problem, because once you get that into the air, and you really can't undo it without winning. And Jeremy Pruitt is not a savvy guy. I mean, Muschamp, for all of his faults, was a personable guy. I mean, I don't know anyone in the media who didn't like him. Kind of guy you wanted to have a beer with on the beach in the summertime. That's not Jeremy Pruitt. I don't know what Jeremy Pruitt's going to say if this season goes to a 3-7 record, and he's going to talk about in the offseason how much better Tennessee is going to be next year. It's not going to be viable or believable.
Paul Feinbaum, minutes ago on our show, talking about Tennessee's issues right now. Coming up at 11 o'clock, Floyd Reese will join us, and we'll break down the Titans as they get ready for the Ravens on Sunday, a huge, huge game for them, needless to say. So a lot of things going on, and Blake Topmeyer has been all over it with some great reporting. We asked Paul a lot about that. And so he talked about, Chase, the spiral of Tennessee and the cycle they've been in, where coach doesn't work out, buy him out. Coach doesn't work out, buy him out. And so they've been paying two staffs more often than they've paid one staff, for over a decade now. And I seem to remember an article on this recently. When you add the basketball in there, which has been the same kind of thing in a lot of cases, I think they're in the top five conservatively in the nation in paying buyouts. In other words, paying money to coaches that don't work for the school anymore. So interesting, with that in the backdrop, there's another article by Topmeyer today about what it would cost to buy out Jeremy Pruitt, which I think is unthinkable right now. But, you know, there's no question the hot seat is there right now.
Yeah, well, and right now I don't see this ending any differently than it has in the past. I mean, it doesn't feel like it's going to get any better. I mean, I don't see some magic switch getting flipped, and you know, he makes the right decisions at quarterback, unless Harrison Bailey just truly is the be all end all and comes in and saves the program, which would be great. But I just feel like that there are other missteps on Jeremy Pruitt's watch that are going to be hard to overcome. And so Blake Topmeyer had an article that came out, yesterday, late afternoon, for the Knoxville News Sentinel, talking about what it would cost to buy out Jeremy Pruitt and his staff. And in the middle of a pandemic, it's crazy to think about that. It's crazy to think about the contract extension that he just got, the raise that he just got. But unfortunately, this is one of those scenarios that the Tennessee Vols find themselves in right now. So his contract runs until January 31st, 2026. That's five more seasons. And if they decided to fire him here in the next few weeks, that buyout would be $12.88 million. So just under the reported 13-ish million for Will Muschamp. That's what they would owe Jeremy Pruitt. Now, if they fired the entire staff, that price would go up to $19.2 million because they would have to buy out the assistants as well. That is a lot of money right now. But, like I said, I think they're going to get to a point where they may not have a choice. It won't be this year. But if this doesn't improve, if we're having the same conversation that we're having right now next year, I think we could be talking about a Jeremy Pruitt buyout in Tennessee looking for yet another football coach. And Philip Fulmer would probably be the one to do it because they just extended him as well. And he's got that excuse of, well, things were in such disarray. I got brought in last minute. This was the guy that, you know, was available, what have you. But I'm glad to hear Paul Feinbaum put the blame on Philip Fulmer, because I don't feel like that's really been done a lot. And it should be. I understand what the circumstances were, and he was put in a tough position, but this is ultimately his hire, and it's just simply not working.
They are still, as Topmeyer points out, they're still paying Butch Jones as we speak. Up through February, they'll be paying him. It's cost them at least $10 million. I think there's been some renegotiations in terms of the entire staff, what they owed each guy. I think it was supposed to be $13 million, according to the article. After some mitigation of damages, Tennessee will have paid out more than $10 million for Jones' staff since they fired him. So $10 million bucks that they're still paying the charges for, and now we're talking about the numbers you just threw out there for Pruitt. It just doesn't make sense to me. You've got to give him some time, but it is tough. I understand for the reasons, you know, you just heard Paul Feinbaum say about Will Muschamp, that you do have to look at the cost of keeping a guy if you feel like it's really going to hurt you. If there's no momentum around the program and you start losing revenue in other places, that over the long haul
and recruits,
it won't help you to keep them. So it's ridiculous money when you get down to it. And I just wonder how some of these schools keep coming up with that kind of cash when there's so many other places where you would think a university could use funds.
Right.
It doesn't make sense.
Well, and this conversation is also a little bit different if Tennessee doesn't lose to Kentucky, if they don't lose to Arkansas. Those are two teams that everybody identifies as, yeah, you should beat them. That should be no problem. Georgia, Alabama, okay, I get it. You're not to that level yet. And they were even competitive against Georgia in the first half, and then the wheels fell off. And that's really when the wheels fell off of the season, was at that point, because then they get blown out the next week to Kentucky. Alabama blows them out, and then we know what happened against Arkansas. So that's why this conversation is happening. It's not because of Georgia in Alabama necessarily. I mean, you expect those teams to be better. It's because you can't beat programs like Kentucky and Arkansas. So you can't even use the, oh, it's an all-SEC schedule excuse, because you're losing to teams within the conference that you usually beat.
Well, that's what, that's what's changed during the season. And when they had the winning streak going, the narrative was, well, they haven't beaten anybody. But I made the point at the time that that's big progress, that that's a big feather in their cap, because they weren't winning those games before. And to be able to consistently beat the middle ground teams and the lower teams, like, for example, the Missouri win was a great decisive win, and the type of win that a program on the rise has. So that's what's changed drastically, and it shows you how quick things can turn, is the loss to Kentucky, the way they lost, right, just blown out of the water, and the loss against Arkansas, because that changes the perception, because now no longer can you say that. Well, we're beating who we're supposed to beat. We're just not quite to the level of the elite yet. So you've taken a step back down right. The staircase. So, you know, this is not a perfect world, right? You're not going to – not everybody is going to win. There's always going to be, at any given time in a 14-team league where everybody thinks they're supposed to win, there's always going to be four or five teams that aren't happy with the direction it's going. You have to try to get through all the noise if you're Philip Fulmer, who watches every day, watches how he goes about his business, and asks the question, can he get through this? Because I think we can set plenty of examples where you think you have the wrong guy, you get rid of him, the next guy comes in and does well. But Tennessee has been burned many times moving on, right? And
right.
And they've paid out a ton of extra money because of it. I can set a lot of examples or cite a lot of examples where a school stuck with a guy and they were rewarded for sticking with him through tough times.
Yeah, and, you know, you also have to ask the question now with how the last hire was handled, the whole Schiano situation, and then Curry.
Well,
just,
I think people were asking the question then.
Sure, sure. If they move on from Pruitt, I mean, if you're whether an up-and-comer, you know, coach, or you're a established coach at a smaller program, are you going to look at Tennessee and go, I'm good. I'll wait for the next one. I'm not going to jump into that mess.
Well, I think that's already happened. I think that's been happening the last two or three cycles. If you take a look, they have not gotten their first choice.
Right, but Philip Fulmer is supposed to be the one to get him out of that, because he's so well-respected in college athletics and had such a good career at Tennessee. But to me, he's not fixing anything. I mean, it just under his watch, it's looking just as bad. So I don't know how you get out of this spiral. That's what I'm saying.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's becoming increasingly tough every time, which all leads to, I honestly think, the only way that they're going to be doing a coaching search is if they lose to Vanderbilt. I cannot see another scenario where they part ways with Pruitt this year.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, this weekend is a coin toss, because Auburn may be 4-2, but Auburn's not that great. I know they show flashes, but, I mean, flashes doesn't mean that, okay, you're a great program. So it's a toss-up. They should beat Vanderbilt, but, you know, Vanderbilt's played a little bit better. They're trying to get some numbers back. You have Ken Seals that is getting a little more confidence as the starting quarterback. And as we've talked about, Willie, I really like Ken Seals. I think there's a lot of upside there. It's just, can they put the time in and develop him the right way? But then no chance against Florida, and probably no chance against Texas A&M if you're Tennessee. So the next two are ones that you really need to try and salvage what's left of this season.
Well, as we've proven already this year, the perception can change with one game. So
sure,
if they win this weekend, all of this goes away, in my opinion. All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back and wrap up the first hour. Don't forget, Floyd Reese will join us at 11 o'clock. So we'll set the table on some of the things that we're going to hit Floyd up about and start turning our attention to the Titans game. Stay tuned. We're coming back with more. Darren, Donick, and Chase here on 102.5 The Game.
From
Boyd Reese coming up at 11. Titans and Ravens in a very important game coming up on Sunday. Can the Titans snap out of it? Can they get back on track? Start looking more like a playoff team, like a championship contending team. Sunday's game will tell us a lot. Let's take a look, Chase, at the injury report yesterday, which came out after we were on the air. And, of course, we'll get more information today. And keep in mind that Wednesday doesn't tell you everything. Friday will tell you a lot more. But there's some things to keep an eye on here. Number one, Roger Saffold, who left the Bears game with a shoulder problem, he was able to shake that off, comes back and plays against the Colts, and hurts his ankle. And you could tell during some times of that game, he was really laboring out there. He did not practice yesterday. I'm really curious on that one.
Yeah, I am too, because that's a big loss, because the left side of your offensive line, even though Tyson Brio has done a admirable job filling in for Taylor Lewan since he was lost for the season with a torn ACL, losing Saffold too would be detrimental to that offensive line. So, you know, you want to see what happens with him today and tomorrow. Are they just holding him out? Is he going to be able to go on Sunday? But you could tell he was limited. So we'll see on him. But he would be a big loss.
Ben Jones also did not practice. Neither did Dennis Kelly. You're hoping that that is just
maintenance. Dennis Kelly was limited.
Yeah, he was limited participation, which is kind of what he's been doing. He has not been practicing fully each week. So you hope that there's nothing new there. But it just shows you how an offensive line can have some wear and tear over the course of the season. They're already down, and that's the cascade effect, right? When you lose your best guy and he's not coming back, and this is something I think we can hit Floyd with, that's what becomes tough. It's like, okay, if we can get by for these 3 weeks and then we get this guy back, even if we lose another guy, at least we've got, you know, our best guy back.
Yeah.
But they're piecing it together in a unit they really need top level play from, and they're out of good depth, which again brings us back to, is there any hope for Isaiah Wilson? I did hear yesterday a very nebulous non-answer, nothing encouraging about Isaiah Wilson's progress about getting closer to actually being an option.
That should tell you a lot. They are limited, or they are thin on the offensive line. They need as much help as they can possibly get, and you can just tell that they're not relying on their first round pick to be able to help them. And, you know, when you say you're without Lewan, I mean, you got to put Isaiah Wilson in that category, even though he hasn't played a game at all for this team. I mean, they've been without him all year for a myriad of reasons, and that's a huge concern. But I don't have any belief that he's going to be playing on this team this year.
At receiver, Corey Davis missed practice yesterday, non-injury related, so you hope that he should be fine by
Sunday. Hopefully a maintenance day.
Yeah, hopefully maintenance. Adam Humphries still not able to practice, coming off of the concussion that he suffered in the Bengals game, so still waiting to see if he could be available anytime soon, but that's not very promising. And then looking at the defensive side, Jadeveon Clowney did not practice. I would imagine that's going to be sort of the routine with his situation, what's been reported on the meniscus issue. And then Adoree Jackson still not able to practice for the Titans on Wednesday. So that really puts, I think, a lot of doubt on his availability this weekend.
Yeah. I'm hoping that Mike Vrabel, when he speaks here in a little bit, will be able to shed a little more light on what's going on with Adoree Jackson. They had to activate him. They did. He is on the active roster right now. We know he didn't play last Thursday, but he is taking up a roster spot. So just how close or how far away is he? Because, you know, the next time they shut him down, I assume that would be for the year. I don't know if he can go back on that 3 week IR, but at this point, I don't know how much good that really does you. So,
well, as we said, you know, there's nothing wrong with the idea that it might take a few more weeks. And even if he gives you the last four games, that's better than zero games, right? But I wonder how this works, right? They're under no obligation to tell us details. And, of course, if you tell the media details, you're telling the other team, you're telling the league. But I wonder if it would take some heat off of Adoree Jackson, because every day we're sitting there going, is he practicing? Is he going to practice? Is he practice tomorrow? What do you think? Is he getting close? You know, would it take some heat off of them PR-wise to say, okay, he's really not close. It's going to be a couple more weeks. You know, he's working as hard as he can. you know, this has been an issue. He had a setback, whatever you want to say. But I wonder how the team reacts. Like, I don't know if they're completely in the know, but, you know, it's tough, I think, looking every day at that injury report and thinking he might be available. And it's just, it seems like it's taking forever. It's like a watch pot never boils. You'll stop watching. You'll get off of that subject, and the other people will know they've got to do the job for an X amount of time, if that's the case.
Right. Yeah, I feel like when they initially took him off, you know, or put him on that designated to return, they thought, okay, he's close. And then at some point in that three-week period, there was a setback, and that has pushed this process back to where we are now. And so now they're kind of stuck and having to do it this way. But I agree with you. I think if they would just come out and say, listen, there was a setback, we're hopeful, but that's all we know right now. They could quiet a lot of things, but they probably won't do that.
I wouldn't hold my breath, but we might ask Floyd about that part of it. Other names that made the injury list: Chris Jackson, illness, did not practice, the defensive back. Certainly they can ill afford to lose any more defensive backs. Rookie defensive lineman Larrell Murchison, a rib injury, did not practice yesterday. Michael Pruitt, still not able to practice. He's been hurt for a while. I don't think I left anybody out. So a sizable injury report, just like every team has right now, but some key guys. They'd love to get some good answers over the next couple of days. All right, let's step away. When we come back, Floyd Reese will join us, and we'll get hot and heavy into the matchup. We'll get the GM's perspective next here on ESPN 102.5 The Game.